So we've moved the previous week to Thursday, as agreed. At 16, and there is a room which is this one. You know it? I think it must be a good one. Okay, so let's go on. I've introduced this IO monad last time and gave a small example. And so the intuition about this IO monad is somewhat similar to the intuition about the state monad, because you can imagine that this IO monad has some underlying state, which is the state of the word, where word includes everything behind the Haskell program. And more concretely, we can internalize this concept inside Haskell, so we can do monad-based computation with respect to some state, where state is something defined internally. So this produces state monad. Which is defined like this: TS is equal to S to which we run is that right? So what this means is that a computation over a program over such monad is the monad with a state. And in particular, so what would be the way to understand it? All right, so first I need to say where this monad is defined, because we have the different categories, and different categories support different monads. So, for example, to define this monoidal module monad, we just need a monad with products. And here, this is not sufficient, because we need to somehow interpret this thing. So a different way to write this down is also like this, which is which may look more suitable, because this distinguishes this a bit from this sort of notation and avoids the confusion with morphisms and exponentials, because this is an object of a category, while we use this notation also to refer to morphisms. And morphisms, objects, are different things. So to interpret this thing, we really need to have objects like this. So we need a notion, an internal notion of a function space. So I use this notation, this and this, interchangeably, and I assume that it's understood that there is this difference, and we distinguish these things properly. But right, having this in mind, state monads can be interpreted only over categories which support exponentiations. So it means we can have an internal notion of functor space, and this is the case with set, for example, because the set of functions is a set again, so it's an object. And it's a case of CPUs, because the set of continuous functions between two CPUs, again, a CPU, so it's also an object. So this works. In sets, CPOs and so more generally in so-called Cartesian closed categories. So we've seen Cartesian categories, these are with products, and Cartesian closed as the one with products and this exponentiation. I don't explain formally what this means, I just give the intuitive idea that these are precisely the one where we can sensibly interpret these exponents. I don't know if we maybe introduce it later if we have time, and I see this is relevant for something else. But presently, you can just imagine that we do the state monad over sets. And this is what I propose you to do in the exercises. So this first exercise is largely about the state monad. And yeah, it's proposed to do it over sets only. But this would likely work with other categories too. OK, and then here I need to say how my monad structure is defined. So I need to say what eta is, for example, eta x, x as something going from s to, no, something going from x to x times s, s. So here that's now this arrow means the morphism arrow. Right, because eta is a natural transformation which I instantiate x, so this must be a morphism. In this sense, this arrow is not the same as this arrow. So we often use them interchangeably because everyone understands the subtlety behind. And I here I emphasize this by using this notation so to distinguish, but just as well I could use two arrows, but these arrows would be different arrows. Although in sets, that's difficult to notice. And what is this function then? So I apply it to x. So if I apply it to x, then the result is a function. So then I can apply it to s again. And what it returns? Well, it returns a pair xs. Right? So we inject a value to computation, and that computation is the one which doesn't change the state. So we've taken a state and we return the same one. So then this is one thing, and then if we have f going from x to y times s, f star goes from x times s, s to y times s, s. All right, how is it defined? F star. Okay, so I need to apply f to a computation. So let's call it p. Okay. So the result is a function. Well, it's a computation again, but this computation is a function. So I can apply it to s. All right, and here there's a small notational challenge, which you do not notice in Haskell, but which is noticeable if you do want to do it a bit using the mathematical notation. So obviously what you want to do here is we want to run this function. Oh, wait. Is this really what we want to do? No. So this is the state which you understand as the current state. So how we obtain the result here, we want to use the state with this computation. This computation transforms the state and produces a new one, and we feed the obtained state to this f. And that produces yet another state. So we form a chain of two computations, and pass the state to the first one. It returns another one. We take it, pass it to the other one, and it transforms and produces yet another one. So I want to basically apply this P2S. Right, so I do not know what's on the left or what's on the right. So, but if I apply P2S, what I would get would be a pair X and new state. So I need to parse it somehow. That's a small notational challenge here. So I can write something like let what X is free, X S prime. Okay. So I want to match the left with X and to right with S prime. And when I have this X and this S prime, I can call F. So I call F with S prime. I get a function taking a state and returning a pair. I call it with X. So I get a function like this, and I feed the new state obtained here to this function. So, and that now types. So that's a little bit like Haskell style trick introduced into mathematical calculations, but we can say that let, we'll say, equal to P in Q is just equal to what? Q with so this is a shorthand for this. I could write this expression just in this notation immediately, but it would be messy and it would be difficult to understand it. That's basically the reason why Haskell notation is sometimes very fortunate, because writing it like this is quite suggestive. If you just stick to the mathematical tradition, you can write it down, but it's not so clear what happens. And what I'm proposing in the exercise is instead of proving that this is a state is a monad, just to prove that a monad transformer is a monad. So because if you just add here a little t, that's still a monad, provided t is a monad, and it looks like something more complex, but in fact you don't need to. The proof would be almost the same, and just instead of this let constructor, you would use the do constructor, and that do constructor would be construct will be the do construct for the monad, which plays a role of the parameter. In this sense. If you do the proof for this parameterized proof for the transformer, you don't need any new notation. You just reuse the do notation, but for the monad, which acts as a parameter. So it would be, instead of let, blah, 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 it would be do x s prime gets this semicolon and the same thing. And that's probably also the reason why it's done like this in Haskell, because I think it was not originally like this, but at some point they have redesigned it. And now, basically, they first introduce a state monad transformer, and then they make the state monad as an instance with t equal to id. But apart from that, is it clear why is it, why it's like this? It's a bit like a trick, but the intuition is that this Kleissley star is supposed to join two computations, and it passes the state and updates the state in accordance with this hypothesis. All right. So, and that's something that I propose to you to do as an exercise to prove that this is a monad, and this is easy, something easier to do if you use this expressivity theorem, because that you don't need to use the strings. Instead, you just prove the three monad laws for it, and they contain the strings implicitly. Okay, what else? So with this definition, you can introduce more operations, because every monad supports the operations. Every monad supports, but every monad is specific, because every monad contains operations, supports operations specific to it. So for example, for the state monad, it's the operations of put and get. So what is put? Put as if we have a state, and then we can produce T1, and get is the other way around. So again, in Haskell, this one is omitted, because you can, instead of functions from one, you can just talk about these objects. But I prefer to write this, at least in this mathematical style, because there is a symmetry. So there is S1 and 1S, which is sort of nice. So, and how are they defined? Put S. So, okay, let's look at the definitions. The definition tells us that we have to return a state monad transformer. So we need to take yet another S, which I call S prime. So, and then we have to return a pair. And this pair will be this one, S. Okay. So what this means is that this S is now put into the state, and this S is discarded. So it's like the running S which we have obtained, and we just neglect it because we want to put a new one. So we return this one. We completely ignore this one, and there is an operation get. All right, so get, let's say X. So this X is something of a unit type, and here again we obtain S as an argument, and so we have to return something of type S times S, and this S times S, to produce it, we just duplicate S. So we obtained S as a parameter, we returned S as a parameter, and additionally we returned S as an argument. So these are the two inherent operations for the state monad which we run with it. So we can organize any stateful computation just by manipulating the state in this way. Right. So another interesting thing connected with this is the connection to the so-called reader monad. So we had seen uh, We have seen something which is often called writer monad, which I previously called monoidal module monad. I mean, there again, there are, so there are mathematical tradition, there's programming tradition. So in the programming, according to programming tradition, this is writer monad. So we have considered it quite extensively. Why is it writer monad? Because we only write. We can only collect the information, but we cannot get any information from the outside. We can accumulate something like the number of iterations, like we've done in the exercises. And we can collect them here. And another of common use of this M is for collecting output. So we can take the monoid of strings. So the type of string is strings is a monoid because you can concatenate the strings, and this is a monoidal operation. And that's explained why it's writer, because you can use it for writing. So you can define a writing operation which keeps attaching strings to this M, and that's understood as the globally returned string. So that's called writer, and it's not quite related to the state monad, but something which is linguistically opposite to it, which is reader. Is actually connected. So it's this thing. So writer monad can only write, and the reader monad can only read. And this thing is formally connected to the state monad because it's a sub monad of the state monad. In which sense? In the sense that, so computations or programs over this of the reader monad are particular kinds of stateful computation where we do not update the state. So, well, or we do not, we don't return the state. So how to connect it formally, right? No, well, we do not change the state. So we cannot. So I probably just provide the intuition. So. Basically, we can introduce a natural transformation alpha from so basically, and can embed this monad into this monad. How is it defined? I take a program like this, and I need to define thing like this. So to define it, I again call it with an arbitrary state S, and I return P of S and S. So I can convert any program over the reader monad to a program over state monad, but the later program would be the one which wouldn't change the state. So here, this S and this S are the same S. So I could be more formal. I could say precisely what means to be a submonad. But to say this, I would need to introduce a notion of monad morphism. So, and I'm not sure if this is probably just going to be the only place where I would use it. So just propose you to trust me that you can formalize the notion of a monad morphism. And then this natural transformation alpha would be a natural transformation in that sense. And moreover, it would be an embedding. So two things are not sent to the same thing. If they are originally different, they are not merged with this alpha. Okay. So maybe we do some exercise with it, like possibly show that that this is a monad, that this is a strong monad by the expressivity theorem. So let's use the expressivity theorem. So I've summarized this expressivity theorem in the assignment sheet more carefully. So we have to define this psi. So what does psi do? So it essentially does what eta does. So I want to introduce a corresponding do expression. So this would be lambda x, lambda s. So does this type? This doesn't really type, does it? So right, so there's something wrong here. So F goes from A to B. So F goes from A to B, and here we want to have something going from X to right. Yeah, so we want to apply it to XS. Right, then this will type. So this whole thing will be of type A to B to S. So this is my psi, and then there is this phi. Okay, so here I have F. No, wait. So F I can apply to X. And then I apply it to S. So then I can call G, right? Right, so that's I'm just simplifying the definition for the state monad, but for the reader monad we do not have this program that we need to parse the pair, because the reader monad returns a single value, so it's just b and not b times s, so you don't need to do, to say something let a pair b equal to, because there is no pair. So instead I just take this value and compose it with G directly. So this would be of type B, and this would be of type A. That's why it types. Okay, and after I've done this, so this would be basically something of type As to see. So, and hence I need to apply to S. Yes, what happens to it? That I'm wondering myself. So is it the problem with phi only, or is it the problem with psi too? Right, so we just need to apply it to the pair, right? That would do it.
And the g of something, isn't it of type C?
Okay, so here f is of type A to B to S to B, and G goes from A times B to S to C, right? So if you apply it to this pair, then you would get this. So, but maybe I was wrong in the first clause. So what we want to get is something of type f g going from a to c to s. Is that the case? It doesn't seem to be the case. Oh yeah, actually yes. Yes. So it just shouldn't be c to s. Okay, so which means I've screwed up here. Okay, and now this makes sense, right? Because it would be suspicious if I didn't use this S twice, because S is like my global context, and both F and G are dependent on it. So I call it once for F, and then I compose it with G, and then I again can use it in G. So this S is like a global store, and both computation, they have an access to it. And they make use of it, of course. Okay, so, and how do I verify the laws for it? That was the hard part. Now, hopefully they're gonna be an easy part. So like, let's check, do x gets p, let x equal to p. So this is one of the laws. And now we can use our semantics, do x gets p, let x. So this is just equal to phi of No, there is no X. And here we've got so this is equal to phi. This is psi of okay, let's just use these definitions now. So I've got, or maybe we just, for convenience, just so just apply them to X and S. So because if I want to show the equality, then it's sufficient to apply it to X and S on both sides. So this would make my calculation a bit simpler. X, S, X, S. So, and then here I get so F is this one, and I get X A S S. Then I've got G, which is this thing. So G takes two arguments. So the first argument is X. The second argument is Fx of S. So I need to call F. Yes. Ah, okay. I'm just writing it again. I need F, of course. So basically, I can kill this context while because because I can just directly use my X and S. Right, so basically the thing is this guy, it's a second projection. Right, so there was a P here, and this is the second projection. So I arrive at this. Right, don't I? Or not, no. So it's a second projection, but it's a second projection inside of Psi. So I write S and D, okay, and X so now we need to take a look at the definition of Psi. So this is my F, this is my X and S, I believe. So, and if I apply my definition of Xi in this case, I would have what I have. F applied to X, S and G of so I have I got lost somehow. Ah, so this X is not more here, no longer here. Right, after this step. But do you mean this transition is correct? I mean, because the point was, so this is essentially a function from two arguments, X and S, which we imply to X and S. So I wanted to simplify it by just leaving the argument.
Yeah.
But Yes, so that step was correct. Maybe something before was wrong, because psi takes. So why is this pair here? Because psi takes takes individual arguments. So it takes f, and it takes x, it takes s. It doesn't take a pair. So maybe I've screwed up even before.
Well, could it be the x down in the definition of psi is actually the pair on the upper blackboard? Because a function is second projection, so we want to apply it to a pair anyway, right?
Yes. Yeah, actually, you're right, yes. This is correct, indeed. So what then? This is right, and this is... And then it must be right, so... Do you agree that we arrive here? Yeah, right. So this is the second projection. So if I take SF the second projection and SX this pair, so what I would get, it would be this. Okay, so this makes sense. So I just write XP XS. Yes. Right, so. And we are done. Right? So, because this is now what we wanted to obtain. Well, gamma in this calculation is any context. So we have to show this this equation in any context, because that's how we do our reasoning. When I write this equation here, it means it's an equation in every context gamma, so which I omitted, but for the calculation, of course, you need to remember it, because the calculation depends on it. Right, so it's not such a Schrödinger calculation, in fact, and there are two more laws. There are two more laws here, so yeah, probably we need to consider again. Taking some liberal point of view at the exercise. So the other equation can be shown in the same way. I cannot probably claim that it's very easy, but it's possible. So it's analogous to this. I just wanted to show you some examples. So I do not want to stick to this for too long, because I wanted to show something interesting about how this is done in Haskell. Mm. so it doesn't count as VGA. Uh-huh. So what, there's this writer mono, for example, which I have commented briefly. Right, so there's a Haskell library which is called control mod writer, and so that's, for example, how I can use it. So this writer is declared to be a monad parameterized by monoid. So the monoid is here in this case a string, a list. So monoid multiplication is concatenation. And I can do something like this, log number x, which just basically concatenates s with a string got number. How does it work? It's the wrong directory. So what was it? Log number. That's wrong. So it doesn't have a print. Doesn't have a print method. So okay, maybe I just do something different. Mold with log. So now I don't remember what was the command for writing it. Yeah, well, I don't remember what was the command for that. Run writer. Ah, okay, run writer. Yeah, thanks a lot. I just don't remember this.
I guess info writer would have
shown. That's what I wanted to do next. Yeah, well. Yes, this would be helpful. Yes, so that's because it's a state it's a monad transformer just like the state transformer. So yeah, they have typical names. You can just guess that it's run writer. But anyway, so that's how it works. So here I've collected 15. So it's just like we've done this with this our exercises. So here there is 3 and there is 5. and the multiplication is 15, and the trace can be recorded. So that's this part records what happened on the way. I like this monoid case. So can I run this GCD example? I've tried this all like 1 week before, and after 1 week I cannot remember anything anymore. GCD. So let's say 15 and 6. So that's another use. I want to calculate greatest common division divisor of 15 and 6, and this is 3. But using the monad, I can also record the steps, because at every iteration I can tell what I'm doing. So this is what this program is doing. So it's not only calculating the greatest common divisor, but it has this common tell, which keeps accumulating the information about the computation step in the monoid, and then in the end you can just read it. So that's the idea how you can use it. So, and then I had an example on the reader. So this is the reader one. Okay, so this is funny because, as you've seen from the types, so the reader monad is something much simpler than the writer monad, because you don't need any additional structure, you don't need a monoid. And in fact, I believe, so wait, how can I see it? Info monad, maybe? Yes, okay. So here you can see the standard instances of the class monad, and most of them you know, and this one is for exactly the reader. So if you replace this R by S, so then it would convert precisely to the same type, because S is used as the first argument for error, so error is a function space, and so you can actually program quite concisely that such a constructor indeed is a monad. And now we basically just use it here. So this is quite cryptic now, because there are no constructors involved, so what is times 2. So times 2 is a function which takes an argument and multiplies it with 2. So it means that it is essentially a program over a reader monad, because it reads the argument and it outputs the value by multiplying to the argument. And so does the second command. And since they are combined with this do notation, the result which you get is the one which is because of the monadic semantics, because by treating this multiply 2 and plus 10 and as using them as functions over monads, so what does it mean? Okay, so I have an example, add stuff 3. So I start with 3 and then I multiply it with 2, so I get 6, and then I add, it's not like this. So yes, I get 6, and then I hold this 6, and then I multiply 3 with, I add 10 to 3, I get 13, and then I sum 6 and 13, so I get 19, hopefully. Let's check it. Stuff 3, yeah. So it's always nice to see that the prediction was correct, right? Okay, so this is clear. And then I had quite a lengthy example, which I basically obtained by extracting it from a paper where monads were like first motivated for the use of Haskell, and this is examples about parsing. I think it's quite nice. So we can basically create like an algebra of parsers, which can parse expressions and convert them to from strings to integers and to characters, etc. So in to the sense, we need this type pState. So it's our state in the sense of the state monad. And this state in this case is a string. So, and then we introduce a new type parser. So, and this parser is defined as the, in a similar sense as we define the monad transformer, but we take a particular monad to transform. So, and this is the list monad. So it's exactly what you get if you apply this state monad transformer over strings to the list monad. So, and therefore this computation, they are going to have two effects, which is state and kind of non-determinism, or if you want to just list, which are collecting values. So, and I can easily make this an instance of all the relevant classes like monad functor and applicative functors, just do it from scratch. Just as well, I could use the standard classes like the state monad transformer. And then I here I define the type of trees which I want to have as the results. So I'm supposed to get as some string as an input, and I want to have a parse tree. So in this parse tree is represents either integers or two things which reflect the operations of integers. So it can be either negation or summation. So I'm supposed to recognize them. Okay, and then I incrementally built this this library by adding more and more features. So like this item thing. Okay, what does it do? I forgot that already. Okay, let's maybe just try to run it. Could match expected type with actual type parser char. So what? So I want to run parser. Yes. Okay, now at least it's clear what it does. So it extracts one character from the line. So that's the simple thing. And then I can combine this item. So I can program function, what, two items? Okay, so what it does, it extracts two things as a pair. Oops. And I do it in the pure monadic style. So I just encoded this, programmed this item. And then I can be modular. I don't need to program two items. Instead, I just call this item two times and return a pair. So, and there's always a background string unparsed string which I do not use. It just stays in the background all the time. So there is there's thing which is called alternation. So, which is helpful if you want to parse something in different ways. And algebraically, we define a structure of a monoid over our our monad for parsing, because we can like say we have a dummy parser which always returns the empty string. So like in this case, right? So this list that this which we obtain in the end, it contains all possible parsers, and dummy just does it silly, nothing. And there is this plus operation which concatenates two possible ways of parsing. So do I have example to this? Yes, one or two, which means what? I will see this. Okay, so basically what happens here is just like before, I either parse once, so I call this item thing once and return the result, or I parse twice, so I call this iter item twice and return this both results. And if I concatenate them with the sum, so what happens is I basically get two variants of the parse. One is I parse once, and one I parse two first letters. And then there is filtering. So it means that I have a condition which I verify. So I'm trying to parse. So the operation receives a parser and a condition. And if the condition is true, we first parse and then we check the condition. If the condition is true, then we return the results of the parse. And if it's false, then we just return call the dummy parser, which returns the empty list of possible parsers. Okay, so that's like the simplest experiment. And now let's try to parse a letter. So what it does here is we again call the item, but conditionally. So we use this filtering construct to check if the result which we obtained is a letter. So do we have an example? Okay, so here it's a successful parse because M is a letter, but if I started with zero, I would have an empty list because the condition would fail. And the same one with digit. So now if I change it to digit, then here successful and here it's not successful. And this is for what? Okay, so it's parsing a specific literal. So I call iter item, but what I'm checking if the result is equal to the char which I passed as a parameter. Okay, so this is like a basic algebra of parsing. And then we can iterate the things, which is certainly what we want when we do parsing, because we do parsing iteratively, or recursively if you wish. So, and there is this construct, iter, which transforms a parser to a parser, but with a different output type. So it's defined recursively. Okay, so we have got an example of parsing number to this effect. So like, we can basically try to to parse a digit and then iterate it until as long as it's possible, and then basically convert the result to a number. Right? So because this iter, it would return me a list, because iter iteratively parses and collects all the sequential characters which we managed to parse, and then we need to represent this list as an integer. So there is a simple auxiliary function here which converts a list of digits as characters to a number. Number. So let's call number. So this is not successful, but with zero it's going to be successful. And for example, 1, 0, this would be, why is it like this? Okay, because this iter, it creates all possible parses, not necessarily the maximal ones. So we have, so that's, I think, also in the reverse order. So from the maximal to the minimum. So the maximal parse would be to parse the whole digit, 0, 1, 2, 1, 0, this will be 10. And the first two, it's 0, 1, so it's 1. And the first 0 is just 0. So, but, so the fact that it's like this is because of the fact obtained this parser for parsing number from iter, and iter involves non-determinism, and non-determinism as this plus operation was symmetric. So the fact that we have this big list is because plus was symmetric. And if we make it non-symmetric, then we can do the same example, but we can have the maximal parses only. So if we redesign this example a bit and introduce this biased choice, which always resolves into the left, so it checks if we didn't fail with the left parser, and right, so if we didn't fail, then we don't call the second one. So, and if you base the recursion on this sort of non-determinism which has priority. So you redefine this iter. So our iter is a re-implementation of iter, but we use this biased choice instead of the symmetric choice. And if we do the same example again, but with our iter instead of iter, we can encode max number, which would only return the maximal parse. Max. Right, so here I get the maximal part, which is 10 in this case.
What happens if the first character is a digit?
Well, it would return empty, because that was part of the definition, that it first tries, and if it's digit, then it proceeds. If it's not, then it does nothing. Okay. And yeah, so here I'm almost done. That's basically was the things that I wanted to do my example. And so what do I do here is I also define this parser which is called minterm. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's not the most elegant example, but bear in mind this all just to illustrate the calculation with the computation with state monad. So my goal is this one, and sometimes you need to have a minimal parse and sometimes maximal parse. So these two things are mutually recursive. So from term I call min term, and from min term I call term. I don't know if one works through this example, that's probably going to be clear why sometimes you need a minimal parse, sometimes a maximal one. I just played with this example and find out this version. So what happens in the min one? So what you try to parse a number and return the parse tree. So we now start involving the parse trees, and all we try to parse this literal bracket, and then we call term, so which is this function. And then in the end, we try to parse the closing bracket. If it doesn't work, then it all fails altogether. So now why I call term is because I want to make a maximal parse. I know that there is a closing bracket, so I eventually want to reach this bracket. And if I parse something that is parsable but doesn't reach the bracket, I would need to parse the rest somehow. That's why here I call the maximum parser, so to say. And there is also minus, which I also try to parse. And the term is similar. And right. So this thing is the one which is called when I try to parse something inside the brackets. And in the brackets, I can also have plus. All right. So how does it work? Let's parse term. Okay, so the advantage here, it never fails. It always tries to parse something. If there is nothing to parse, then it returns just the empty list. And otherwise, it tries to parse as far as it goes. So here, it can parse a number. So it parses 10 and leaves the rest monad unparsed. If I had something like plus 1, maybe, I'm not sure if it works, yes. So then it constructs a tree, a parse tree, which is a summation, and this is a constant, this is another constant, and I can, so here one is unary, so I cannot write something like 10 minus 1, because 1 is unary, but I can write something like plus minus 1. So, and it would recognize negation, for example. Okay, so I guess it's a very nice example because it shows the benefits of using this kind of style of programming with using monads, because you can abstract many things away and stay modular and involve like some algebraic intuition about fixed points and non-determinants and things like that. Okay, that's it then. Thank you.